On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, ITRC's Understanding Vapor Intrusion, Introductory Concepts and Fundamentals Session 1, which is based on material in the ITRC Vapor Intrusion Toolkit that was released in January 2026. My name is Taylor Vogel, and I will be your moderator for today's training. Many resources from this toolkit will be referenced. Each slide link directs you to the toolkit page, which serves as the central landing page for all materials, including fact sheets, text sheets, checklists, and the technical and regulatory guidance. Jump links on the left side of the toolkit page will help you easily navigate the content. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or ITRC, is a program of the Environmental Research Institute of the States, a 501c3 education and research nonprofit corporation affiliated with the Environmental Council of the States. We are a national coalition composed of members from state agencies, federal government, tribal governments, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. Our members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses. Please visit the ITRC website if you're interested in becoming an active member or need to view the full ITRC disclaimer. If you plan to use ITRC materials, we ask that you review those terms and conditions in detail and be sure to credit ITRC. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. I now have the pleasure of introducing today's trainers. They have all volunteered time over the years for many ITRC products, including developing and delivering this training today. I'm now going to turn this over to Jennifer from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources to get us started with today's training.
All right. Thank you, Taylor. I'm just going to turn my photo on here, or my video on for just this first slide for an introduction, then I'll turn that off to save on bandwidth or space. But as Taylor explained, we're here about the Vapor Intrusion Toolkit. And I want to tell you just a little bit about how that came to be. On the very bottom of the screen, there's a list of three guidance documents that ITRC had previously published. The first one was from 2007, the Vapor Intrusion Pathway. That was the real first ITRC guidance introduction on vapor intrusion. Then in 2014 came a document, a guidance document on petroleum vapor intrusion. And finally, in 2020, we came up with the technical resources for vapor intrusion mitigation. So the VI team with ITRC worked the last couple of years to consolidate and update the science of those three documents to create the VI toolkit that we're going to be talking with you about today. And the reason is what it says right on top, to provide the best practices and defensible approaches to support when we have VI data-driven decision-making. So the toolkit, here's a screenshot from the web where the toolkit is. There's a primary guidance document with appendices. And then as Taylor said, it's also supported by lots of fact sheets, technology information sheets, checklists, and some other training resources for you. All right, I'm gonna turn my video off and advance to our next slide here. So that's just an introduction to the toolkit itself. We do encourage you to open up that toolkit and follow along during the training. And I want to point out that we're not talking about mitigation during this training because we do have a standalone mitigation training covered over two different sessions. So who developed the VI toolkit? Compiling those pre-existing resources and updating them to include the latest science and create this toolkit was really a massive collaborative effort from a variety of stakeholders from across the country. So we had administrative support from ITRC, and the team was led by three state regulators from three different states. The participants included, who's listed here in the green boxes, local, state, and federal regulators, environmental consultants, private and public site owners, professors and researchers in academia, industry-specific suppliers, and community stakeholders. So all of these people volunteered their time to make this toolkit possible. The photo on the right is a portion of the team that was able to attend one of our in-person meetings. All right, let's review who should use this toolkit. It was important to have so many different perspectives contribute since the VI toolkit serves as a resource for so many different people. So the document is primarily written for state and federal regulators. That's the primary goal of ITRC, but it is used by lots of other people in the industry. So we know that vapor intrusion is certainly part of an environmental investigation and cleanup, but it's also part of everyday actions that we all do, like property transactions, refinancing, community planning, redevelopment projects, when we decommission industries, and just, lots more. So as shown by this graphic, we'll start at the top and move around clockwise. Vapor intrusion affects lots of stakeholders, including environmental regulators, as we've talked about, practitioners like environmental consultants, site property owners and managers and occupants, responsible parties, and developers. But there's also lots of other stakeholders, such as suppliers of the investigative tools, laboratories that analyze the samples, health assessors that evaluate the data, mitigators that interrupt the pathway and protect the occupants, and there's just lots of other people. So the VI toolkit is a resource for all of these stakeholders. While there are a variety of perspectives and goals, it is important to say that one aspect applies to all of them, regardless of who you represent, is the need to communicate with each other because there are so many people involved in these projects. There is more on communication in Chapter 3 of the toolkit, the main guidance document. So let's give a little introduction to the variability across the states. This graphic that you see here on slide 9 is a publication from 2024, and it is going to be discussed in a little bit additional detail later in this session. But the VI toolkit, specifically in Appendix A, includes additional details about vapor intrusion guidance per state. It'll identify whether or not they address maybe only petroleum vapor intrusion, or they address other contaminants. Lists what the attenuation factors are and the screening levels. And we'll talk about those in more detail in a little bit about whether or not mitigation is required or when it's required, et cetera. So that's all laid out in Appendix A if you want to see how it varies throughout the state. But the point of this slide here in the introduction is to point out that the rules and the guidance vary dramatically across our country. So it's important to reference the rules and the guidance applicable to the state or territory where a specific site that you're working on is located. We're going to emphasize this a couple of times throughout our presentation. All right, this is a figure from the VI toolkit. So regardless of where you're located geographically, the process, the strategy about vapor intrusion is what remains the same. So this figure from the toolkit, which is referenced down below, figure 1.1, shows different components of a strategy for vapor intrusion and the stepwise approach to go through and follow throughout the vapor project. So starting on the left with the preliminary VI exposure assessment, where we may find out that there is no vapor-related component, or we might find out that we need to move forward with more assessment. And then we move throughout the multiple vapor intrusion project stages that is shown here in the lighter blue categories to the right, where we move through things like vapor assessment and data evaluation. Then we might move on to vapor management, and at the end, vapor component completion. So those are the kind of stages that we move through. And including on this graphic is where there's opportunity to exit the vapor portion of a project. And that's shown by the darker blue arrow across the middle of the figure with more detail listed on there below. So we don't expect you to take all of this in on this one slide. It is in the toolkit, and we're going to show you a simplified version of this strategy in the next slide. But before we move on, I want to draw your attention to the top bar that shows that community engagement starts at the very beginning of a site and continues throughout the whole life of the project. And we'll talk about that more in a little bit too. So here's the simplified version, and you'll see pieces of this as we move throughout the presentation today. The importance of community engagement throughout the project is emphasized here in the top green bar on the above. But before our listeners here today can really fully appreciate the need for and the emphasis on community engagement, we first need to make sure that everyone understands the complexity with vapors and this pathway in general. So for this reason, we're going to talk about community engagement at the end of this first session. So as we consider starting at the preliminary exposure and assessment and move throughout the various project stages, there are some common questions related to vapor intrusion to answer. So for example, we might be asking initially, is the contaminant that we're dealing with sufficiently volatile and toxic such that exposure to this contaminant vapor is even a concern? So we'll talk about volatility and toxicity and performing that initial assessment in a little more detail. If there are vapors of concern and we move into assessment and evaluation, we may ask, are the vapors migrating to an occupied building? We'll talk about vapor transport today. And if we find contaminant vapors in a building, we might be asking, are they the result of vapor intrusion, like truly coming from environmental contamination? Or is what we're finding from background sources, such as cleaning chemicals in the building or off-gassing from furniture or carpet, maybe a gas can in the basement or something? So we'll talk about data evaluation and decision making as well. So this VI toolkit and this training is designed to walk you through this process and show you where you can find more information in the toolkit itself. All right, here is an introduction of some of the common acronyms related to vapor intrusion. And we're going to use these throughout the presentation today. You're welcome, actually encouraged to take a screenshot of this jargon if you're not familiar with it, so you can reference it throughout this presentation, because once we introduce it, then we don't spell it out anymore. So as with any science, there's jargon, right? So when we're talking about environmental contamination and vapor intrusion, there's some very specific jargon that we'll be using throughout here. Okay, before we get started, we're going to start with a poll. We just want to get an idea, check in with all of you, and see who is joining us today. So, if you could, please select the interest here that you mostly represent. Just select one choice. And while everyone is doing that, I think just seeing this list of the type of people that we anticipate to even be taking this training is a good reminder of the various perspectives and interests at play here when we're talking about vapor intrusion that we talked about here in the introduction. All right. Oh, great. Okay. So we've got, we can see that as we anticipated, we're get primarily local or state regulators and environmental consultants, some federal regulators, but we also have some folks representing some other portions of it. Great. Okay, so you can go ahead and close that screen when you're done taking a look at that. All right, so our learning objectives today, in this first session, we're going to define vapor intrusion, what it is and what it is not. We're going to talk a little bit about the science of vapors, vapor movement, and the basic pathways that vapors travel. We'll go over some common vapor intrusion scenarios and then look at some data, the soil data, groundwater, vapor concentrations, in addition to some other lines of evidence to develop the conceptual site model. And then we'll walk through that decision-making process. And finally, we'll end with the critical part of any successful project, which is stakeholder communication and involvement. That's also known as community engagement. All right, so here is our training roadmap. I want to introduce our next speaker, Ryan Jones with Brown and Caldwell. He's going to answer the question for us, what is vapor intrusion? And also go over the basics of the VI pathway. So I will advance for the next slide and take it away, Ryan.
Thanks, Jennifer. I'll turn my camera on for the at least the first slide. But so what is vapor intrusion? And we're going to really begin at the basics, the basic of the science of vapor intrusion. And with that, we need to understand what vapor intrusion is and what are the elements that need to be present in order for vapor intrusion or VI to be a potential concern. So broadly speaking, vapor intrusion is just simply the migration of vapor-forming chemicals from a subsurface source to an overlying building that is occupied or could be in the future. And we're going to kind of take vapor intrusion and look at it from a bottom-up approach. And when I say that, I mean that there needs to be a subsurface source of VFCs, whether it's in groundwater or soil or even the soil vapor itself. And the VFC has to be sufficiently toxic, or think of it as it has to have some sort of screening level. And there has to be a migration route by which the vapors can be transported from that subsurface source to a building, and that building has to be susceptible to soil vapor entry or soil gas entry. And there has to be a potential for receptors. So whether it's occupied buildings or if there's potentially a future building that could be occupied. And if any of these are not present, then the vapor intrusion exposure pathway likely screens out. So, when could a vapor intrusion assessment be needed? Well, simply put, anytime there's the potential for a vapor forming compound to be present in the subsurface, which could be part of a property transaction, other site assessments, or other situations where the inhalation exposure pathway really cannot be ruled out. So, what makes vapor intrusion unique? Well, it's a unique pathway. It's typically an involuntary exposure. Most people that are in a building where there is vapor intrusion occurring, they don't know that it's occurring. And we have overall conservative screening levels that can really even drive groundwater screening level concentrations lower than drinking water standards. And screening levels will be discussed a little bit later. It's a complex the transport mechanism is complex, and it's influenced by numerous processes. And really, variability is the rule rather than the exception. We see variability, with changing of the seasons, daily variation, even the influence of the building itself. And really, it's important to just remember that vapor intrusion is typically it's episodic and not normally a continuous exposure pathway. And it can have critical influence for land use and drive long-term management requirements, which will be that'll be covered a little bit more in detail in the second session. But as mentioned, for the VI or vapor intrusion component to be present, there has to be a source of VFCs in the subsurface. So I keep using the term VFC. So what is a VFC? It includes chemicals that are sufficiently volatile and can easily move into the vapor phase. And most guidance documents, most states, they've adopted the US EPA definition, whereas the Henry's Law coefficient is greater than or equal to 10 to the minus 5 atmospheres per cubic meter per mole. And or the definition of vapor pressure being greater than 1 millimeter of mercury. And there are some compounds that meet the Henry's Law definition or the vapor pressure definition, and sometimes both. And 1,4-dioxane and some PFAS isomers may fall into the either or category. But and PC and TC and benzene, they're pretty commonly observed in vapor intrusion investigations, and they're examples of being sufficiently volatile, but they're also sufficiently toxic. That's the other part of a VFC that can really determine whether or not vapor intrusion is a driver. And for vapor intrusion, the sufficiently volatile compounds they have to also be sufficiently toxic in order to potentially drive a vapor intrusion risk. And for soil, that means the pure component vapor concentration exceeds an indoor air risk level. Or for groundwater, the saturated vapor concentration exceeds the indoor air risk levels. Now, there are some naturally occurring chemicals that do meet the definition of sufficiently volatile and maybe even sufficiently toxic, but this training generally does not cut it doesn't cover those chemicals or really address other issues, such as PFAS or odor issues. Now, I will say that PFAS, the science around PFAS is evolving. And ITRC does have a PFAS vapor intrusion fact sheet that was released with the ITRC vapor intrusion toolkit. And that was developed through a collaborative effort between the ITRC VI team and PFAS teams. So we've discussed what vapor intrusion is. So let's take a moment just to clarify what vapor intrusion is not. And vapor intrusion is not the same as occupational exposure or where chemicals of potential interest are used in normal operations at a facility. That would fall under different areas that are governed by occupational exposure scenarios. And most emergency response situations, while they're not vapor intrusion initially, under most conditions, they can lead to vapor intrusion. So, other situations that are generally not considered vapor intrusion but can confound vapor intrusion assessments would include direct volatilization, which is the off-gassing of VFCs directly to indoor air without migration through soil or across a foundation. With this, you can think of impacted soil that's in contact with a foundation or where maybe impacted groundwater enters a building through cracks or through a sump and other entry points. And also background sources, which can be from indoor or outdoor sources that can contribute to indoor air VFC concentrations. And many compounds that are often risk drivers in vapor intrusion investigations can be found in products in your house, in facilities, and or are commonly even detected in outdoor air, especially in urban or more industrialized areas. Now, these situations should be accounted for in vapor intrusion assessments as they can confound interpretation of whether vapor intrusion is occurring or not, and if risk is actually related to vapor intrusion. So now that we've covered what vapor intrusion is, we need to know how does it happen. And as we mentioned previously, vapor intrusion, it starts with that subsurface source. So how does the source get there? Well, there's many opportunities for a subsurface source to become a concern, and it can result from spills or other releases to the environment or at your site of interest, and it can also be the result of spills or releases on other properties that impact groundwater and which can then migrate off-site and affect adjacent properties. So how do you know if a subsurface source is present? Well, that's typically determined through environmental assessments. And the environmental assessments are—they're conducted for many reasons. And for example, you may have hazardous sites that where investigations are required under the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, or RCRA, to assess the nature and extent of contamination associated with releases at those sites. Or in many states have spill rules that require some level of assessment and cleanup. Commercial real estate transactions may also trigger environmental assessments if there's some evidence of contamination that's found during a phase 1 environmental site assessment. And although specific regulations or motivations may differ, the assessment process typically begins with sampling of soil or groundwater. And the vapor intrusion assessment might come or even typically comes a little bit later, depending on the soil or groundwater results. And As such, the vapor intrusion assessments are, they tend to be, subsets of other larger environmental assessments and cleanup projects. The common types of sites where vapor intrusion might be evaluated would include industrial sites, manufacturing sites, dry cleaners is a common type of site, or gas stations. And vapor intrusion evaluations may also extend to adjacent or other nearby properties. So, how does a subsurface source become a vapor intrusion assessment? Well, the vapors have to move away from the source through migration and transport processes. And the vapor intrusion, it begins, as we've mentioned, from the source, and migration and transport begins with the phase in which the VFCs exist in the subsurface, or phase partitioning. So the vapors have to then migrate from a source to a building through transport mechanisms such as diffusion, which is the natural movement of a chemical from an area of higher concentration to an area of lower concentration, through advection, which is just the chemicals moving within air or the vapor mass that's likely caused by differential pressures, and also transported through mixing and dilution in building air itself. We're also going to discuss how soil gas concentrations can attenuate through the vadose zone, and we'll go over many of the subsurface considerations and processes that are part of really every component of migration and transport, and can even influence the concentrations and inherent variability. So for vapor intrusion, as we mentioned, you have to have a release of VFCs of some sort. So once a subsurface source exists, transport of VFCs from sources to buildings begins with the partitioning of the VFC molecules from source media, followed by transport of the molecules to other compartments. And it's important to emphasize that all phases can contribute to vapor intrusion. So the sources of the VFCs in soil vapor that can include VFC contaminated groundwater at the water table, impacted soils in the vadose zone, and light or even dense non-aqueous phase liquids above the water table. And the VFC molecules partition from can partition from water to the or the soil or the non-aqueous phase liquids to a vapor phase in unsaturated voids in the vadose zone, and in some cases complete or almost complete volatilization to where the original source is no longer present, and that's often called a vapor cloud. But that's where where the soil vapor itself can then become the source of vapor intrusion and become the actual source of vapor intrusion. And the image on the right is really just a simplified diagram just showing how all of phases can contribute to vapor intrusion. And the one on the left, it shows how each of the phases can really coexist simultaneously in the vadose zone. So partitioning and the nature of the source can result in really overall heterogeneous concentrations in the subsurface. And for vapor intrusion, the VFCs must be somewhat proximal to a building and really at elevated concentrations or a source strength. So simply put, the potential for vapor intrusion increases the closer a source is to a building, or potential increases with increased source concentration or increased source strength. And it's important to note that these are the foundations for concentration and distance-based screening that that'll be discussed a little bit later. These images depict really two types of sources: a shallow source, potentially, we'll say from a underground storage tank, and a deeper source from groundwater. And what they show is that indoor air concentrations can yield vastly different results, sample results, depending on the subsurface source strength and the proximity of the overlying building to that source. And really, the same goes for. If you were to, for soil gas, if you were to sample soil gas at various depths, you're going to have the same variability depending on where you, how close the sample is to the source, and whether it's a deep source or a shallow source. So we can see a lot of variability with depth and laterally. So migration and transport, it typically begins with diffusion, which, you know, as we mentioned, was just the natural movement of a chemical from higher concentration, such as the DFC in the source area, to an area of lower concentration, such as area of the vadose zone at some distance from the source. And with diffusion, you can, you know, think of it as it's the molecules moving. It doesn't necessarily mean the soil gas itself is moving. And diffusion transport, it proceeds relatively quickly in gaseous phase relative to aqueous phases, and it can be slowed or redirected in areas where there's water or high moisture in the subsurface. And you know, areas of low permeability can also redirect diffusive transport. But in general, if you're, you know, the further you are from the source, the lower the concentration. Then inconsistent concentrations may indicate that at one, the conceptual site model may be poorly understood, or you know, you've identified, you know, some data gaps. There could be multiple sources, you know, at work, or that maybe there was an error, you know, introduced by the sampling and analysis itself. Advection is just the, you know, that's the soil vapor moving. So in advective transport is typically it's typically the primary transport mechanism, moving the VFCs across building foundations of the slab. And you can think of it as it's drawing the vapor up from the subsurface into a building that's at lower pressure. Or, you know, conversely, you can have downward movement if the building is at a higher pressure relative to the vadose zone. So the movement of vapor mass is, we mentioned you know, briefly, that it's likely caused by differential pressures. But much like diffusion, it can proceed quickly. You know, it can also proceed qu quickly along, you know, vapor intrusion preferential pathways. But it can be slowed and redirected in low permeable zones. And with advective transport, you know, we often see a high degree of temporal and spatial variability due to the differences in differential pressures that are, you know, that can be caused by HVAC operation, wind, you know, wind creating shear effects or stack effects from temperature changes. You know, maybe, you know, hot air rises and pulls the soil gas up with it, and just regular diurnal trends and other, you know, other weather-related impacts. And it's important to note that even the building itself influences vapor intrusion. You know, soil gas mixes with the indoor air and can circulate and transport over distance indoors. And with this, the concentrations can become dilution. It can become diluted, and dilution is, or the amount of dilution is really, it's based on the volume of the building. And there are natural factors that can influence, you know, the degree of mixing and dilution in indoor air, such as, you know, temperature, you know, pressure, as we mentioned, wind, and you know, has there been recent precipitation, their overall climate and soil type, and the amount of moisture, you know, in the subsurface. There's also some, you know, man-made factors such, you know, HVAC operation. You know, and actually the HVAC operation influences the building pressure and the indoor air exchange rate, or the introduction of outdoor air to the indoor environment. Heating can cause the stack effect, and building can in the building conditions itself. Is it a, what's the age of the building? Is the what's the condition of the foundation or the size of the building? But some general things to take away is that vapor behavior is inherently complex and dynamic, and especially at shallow depths. And there are multiple compartments, and vapors transport, you know, from these compartments and through these compartments. So an important concept is the attenuation, you know, from each compartment to the next. Attenuation, excuse me, attenuation is just simply the reduction of vapor concentrations or an impediment of vapor migration due to natural or man-made factors. And the amount of attenuation is described by the attenuation factor. The attenuation factor is just, it's a unitless value that represents the ratio between measured concentrations between two media. So that in this case, it could be the attenuation factor from indoor air to subslab soil gas or deeper soil gas, or for groundwater, it's the indoor air concentration divided by the concentration in groundwater multiplied by Henry's law coefficient. And it's important to remember that the smaller the attenuation factor or the lower the number, the more attenuation is indicated, or inversely, the larger an attenuation factor indicates less attenuation. And the attenuation factors are used to develop screening levels for soil gas or groundwater, and which are based on indoor air screening levels. And screening levels in the air are think of them as there's a concentration below which no impacts to human health would be expected. And since soil gas and groundwater screening levels are derived from indoor air screening levels and applying an attenuation factor, the soil gas or groundwater screening levels would be the concentrations below which you would not expect indoor air screening levels to be exceeded. The soil gas and groundwater screening levels can be calculated using attenuation factors. And most states have adopted the US EPA default attenuation factors of 0.03 for soil gas and 0.001 for groundwater. The default attenuation factors for soil gas and groundwater are, they were originally developed to be deliberately conservative, and they were designed so that 95% of the time, indoor air concentrations will be lower than what would be indicated using the default attenuation factor. But it's important to point out that the concept of assumed proportionality, it doesn't always hold true for all compounds. This assumed ratio, it breaks down for degradable compounds such as petroleum hydrocarbons that will degrade in the presence of oxygen. So to calculate a soil gas screening level, what is just, the indoor air concentration divided by the attenuation factor. For groundwater, it's the indoor air concentration divided by the attenuation factor multiplied by the unitless Henry law coefficient and a unit conversion factor. Indoor air concentration can, therefore be estimated if the soil gas concentration is known, or at least, assumed to be estimated. So, for example, we would want to estimate indoor air concentration. We would just multiply the attenuation factor by the soil gas concentration. So, if we have a soil gas concentration of compound X that's 1200 micrograms per cubic meter, multiply that by the default attenuation factor of 0.03, it gives us an estimated indoor air concentration of 36 micrograms per cubic meter. So, what can attenuation factors be used for? Well, as I've already mentioned, they're used primarily to develop screening levels or estimate indoor air concentrations. And the screening levels are developed basically to identify site investigation requirements and determine, the need for building-specific sampling. In some cases, they can be used to delineate, vapor intrusion potential in order to prioritize areas for investigation, or with any luck, screen an area out. Indoor air screening levels, that they are, as I mentioned, they are conservative. And I've also mentioned that the attenuation factors are conservative. So there is a level of confidence that if a site or a building screens out when applying attenuation factors to predict indoor air risk, you can, have a level of confidence in the result. The caveat is in the form of the vapor intrusion preferential pathways or building conditions that may promote vapor intrusion. That can change some of the conclusions you may have. But also, if the applicable regulatory authority allows, you can use attenuation factors to develop cleanup goals. Through a multiple lines of evidence evaluation, you can identify appropriate attenuation factors for site-specific cleanup, or use attenuation factors in risk assessment to confirm attainment of cleanup objectives, or if potentially long-term management is necessary. So everything we've discussed really to this point, it helps build the vapor intrusion conceptual site model. We can think of it as it's a puzzle. And through the migration and transport, screening levels, the phase partitioning, the influence of the building, think of those as kind of the sides and the corner pieces of a puzzle. And all the middle pieces are the additional lines of evidence, that we'll discuss a little bit later. But those really give the additional clarity to an investigation. And the conceptual site model, it should be developed early in an assessment or an investigation, and it identifies and defines the key characteristics of a site that are relevant to vapor intrusion. It describes what's known versus unknown with regards to sources and the nature and extent of impacts, and is really the foundation for evaluating transport, fate, and potential exposure. But please remember that the conceptual site model, it's not static. It should be dynamic and updated throughout an evaluation as additional information is obtained. And with that, I will hand it over to Lila Beckley, who will go a little bit more in depth and go over some common vapor intrusion scenarios.
Lila.
Ah, there we go.
No worries.
Sorry, there's a thunderstorm in Austin and it's messing with my computer.
Oh,
So,
really?
as Ryan was alluding to, there's a lot to think about here with respect to vapor intrusion. In this next section of the training, we are going to show you some common VI scenarios to help you put together the puzzle pieces that Ryan's been talking about. There we go. Okay, so what might vapor intrusion look like? The slide here shows two common conceptual models for vapor intrusion. The figure on the left side is what we're calling conventional vapor intrusion. This is the way practitioners have been thinking about the vapor intrusion pathway for the longest time, decades really. The figure on the right side illustrates a conceptual model that's come into focus more recently. So, in the last 5 years or so, there's been an increased understanding of the role that vapor flux through the inside of underground conduits plays in enhancing the risk of vapor intrusion. These conduit vapor intrusion preferential pathways, or VIPs, provide for an increased flow of vapors that's higher than expected compared to typical vapor transport through the vadozone soils. So, let's talk about each of these conceptual models in more detail. This slide shows the conventional vapor intrusion conceptual site model, including those three main components that Ryan was talking about. First, we've got to have a subsurface source of vapors. Second, we've got migration through the vadozone. Note that in this conceptual model, a portion of the pathway is through the soil and is diffusion controlled, which limits the potential for mass flux. Third, we've got vapor entry into the building itself. This is usually controlled by advection, that is, flow following pressure gradients. A variety of vapor entry points is possible at this point. In the building slab, you could have cracks in the concrete, you could have expansion joints, you could have gaps or cracks in the floor wall perimeter. You can also have vapor entry points associated with plumbing defects. Faulty toilet seals can act as vapor entry points, as can floor drains. If you've ever looked underneath your kitchen sink, you've probably seen a P-trap. That's a U or a P-shaped section of pipe that normally holds a small amount of water to create a seal that prevents sewer gases from entering the building. If that P-trap is dry and there are vapors in the sewer line, you could end up with a vapor entry point. So conduit vapor intrusion works a little bit differently. Conduit VI allows advective transport from the source to the building inside the pipe. And this is a lot less limited with respect to mass flux than conventional vapor intrusion. So there are a number of different scenarios where a conduit vapor intrusion preferential pathway may be the source of your VI issue. Example one shows a common one. In this example, sanitary sewer line intersects contaminated groundwater. If you have this situation, the contaminated groundwater can infiltrate into the pipe. Once there, your VOC, your vapor forming compounds can volatilize within the sewer and migrate to the building, say through a sewer lateral. Example two shows discharge of groundwater to a sewer line. This might happen, for example, if you've got authorized discharge of treated groundwater to a wastewater treatment plant. If sufficiently high vapor concentrations remain in groundwater after treatment, they could volatilize, resulting in VFCs in the vapor phase within the sewer line. These vapors could then migrate into buildings that are connected to that line. So that's just another example of a conduit vapor intrusion preferential pathway. We do have a VI preferential pathways fact sheet that elaborates on these examples and gives you more examples if you'd like to take a deep dive into VIPs. So I've been talking about two pretty common conceptual models for vapor intrusion, but there are others. For example, you could have an elevator sump and shaft that we're terming a vertical VIP. In this scenario, there's a shortened diffusion pathway because of the depth of the sump and enhanced pressure differentials resulting from movement of the elevator. These things in combination could preferentially draw vapor forming compounds from the surface, subsurface into your building. You might also have non-aqueous phase liquids directly in contact with the building. In this situation, diffusion through the slab would be the dominant mechanism for vapor transport. Another scenario is a vacant lot with subsurface VFC contamination. Of course, vapor intrusion would not be a current exposure pathway, but there might be the potential for future vapor intrusion if the land use changes and, say, the lot is converted to a residential development. So the site details may vary, and there are a lot of potential situations where vapor intrusion could occur, but there is a common theme throughout all this. You have to have these three required elements: the subsurface VFC source, migration and transport, and the associated mechanisms, and a receptor. So before we go any further, I would like to take a poll and see which scenarios you all have encountered. A through E are different scenarios that I've mentioned already, and a perfectly valid answer is F, done, because we recognize this is a Vapor Intrusion 101 course, and you may be just dipping your toe into vapor intrusion. Okay. Give you a few moments. And then Taylor will bring up the answers. So thank you all for joining in the poll. And yeah, this is the answers that the trainers kind of expected, that most people have encountered conventional vapor intrusion. And it's interesting to me that there are a number of folks who responded that have dealt with the vapor intrusion preferential pathways, because as I said, those that particular conceptual model is relatively new. Okay, so we will move on to the next slide. have been talking about different conceptual models where the vapor intrusion pathway is complete or potentially complete. That's illustrated in this figure, panel A. But it's important to recognize that vapor intrusion doesn't always happen. There are a number of factors that can limit the risk of vapor intrusion at a given site. These factors include an impermeable building foundation, shown in panel B. You could have positive indoor air pressure relative to the subsurface that would suppress the advective flux of vapors into the building. You could have fine-grained geological layers, clays in the subsurface, biodegradation. You could also have a freshwater lens. All of these things would suppress and decrease the risk of vapor intrusion. This figure is a simplification to illustrate these basic concepts. It's important to recognize that, for example, the presence of clay won't necessarily stop VI cold in its tracks, but studies have shown increased attenuation in fine-grained soils that do reduce the potential for vapor intrusion. Please do refer to the ITRC toolkit. It's got a lot more information on these factors and why they're important. Okay, so there are also a number of factors that influence concentrations that you might measure, both above ground and below ground. Above ground, as Ryan mentioned, the building itself influences concentrations with potential background sources and operation of the heating, ventilation, and air conditioning systems. The land cover can also influence concentrations, including concentrations below ground in soil gas. So the figure on the right shows the modeled effect of land cover on vapor concentration distribution in the ground. So in this illustration, the panel at the top shows a building with bare ground over a vapor source in the subsurface. US EPA's modeling showed that with no surface cover, you have a certain distribution of chemical concentrations in the ground. But with impermeable cover, say pavement across the area, that changes the distribution, and you could result in seeing higher concentrations shallower in the surface. So that was some modeling that EPA did more than a decade ago that's been borne out by a lot of direct studies. So there are also a number of subsurface factors that can influence concentrations. For example, in some parts of the country, the water table elevation can change significantly in different seasons, affecting the separation distance between the VFC source and the receptor. This changing distance can affect concentrations that you'll measure. Also within the vadose zone, air and water coexist in pore spaces of soil or rock, as Ryan mentioned. This can influence both abiotic and biotic components. And the interaction between these factors determines the extent and impact of vapor intrusion. For example, if you have high microbial activity in moist soils, that might reduce vapor levels in the subsurface. And in contrast, if you've got dry, sandy soils with minimal microbial presence, that could facilitate faster vapor migration. So, lots of things to think about. The contaminant type is also something that's important to think about. So, as I mentioned, vapor degradation in the subsurface is influenced both by biotic and abiotic processes. While many chemicals of concern in environmental assessments experience similar behavior in terms of partitioning, for example, microbial activity has a significant effect, in particular, on petroleum hydrocarbons, such as benzene. Petroleum hydrocarbons can degrade more rapidly than most non-petroleum compounds due to this aerobic microbial activity in the vadose zone, and this can limit the potential, in particular, for petroleum vapor intrusion. So, in contrast, most non-petroleum compounds, like chlorinated hydrocarbons such as tetrachloroethylene, these tend to degrade more slowly and degrade under anaerobic conditions. So, using these different degradation processes, in your conceptual site model is really critical when assessing pathways at contaminated sites, because the contaminant type and the behavior in the vadose zone will have a big impact. Okay, so the high degree of aerobic biodegradation in the vadose zone is really a very big deal in large capital letters. Of the universe of potential sites that might be assessed for vapor intrusion, there is a wide variety of chemicals with different susceptibility to aerobic biodegradation. Non-petroleum compounds like tetrachloroethylene or trichloroethylene are less susceptible to biodegradation than the petroleum compounds, as I mentioned. So at many industrial sites, you could encounter releases of petroleum or non-petroleum compounds of both. At dry cleaner sites, you're more likely to encounter non-petroleum compounds. However, at gas station sites, the releases, if any, are more likely to be petroleum. So, because of the degree of aerobic biodegradation in the vadose zone, these petroleum hydrocarbon sites tend to have the lower potential for vapor intrusion. And so this is important because, as a broad category, gas station sites then can often be screened out using simple methods, such as source to building separation distance that we'll talk about in a moment. So these sites can tend to be screened out more simply than other types of sites, your dry cleaner sites, your industrial sites. So before we go on, we will pause, take a break, and answer some questions.
All right, thank you, Lila. As Lila mentioned, we have now reached our first Q&A portion of the training about midway through today, and we'll have another Q&A break at the end of today's training. And I do have a couple of questions for our trainers. First one I have, if a VOC is detected in both subslab soil vapor and indoor air, but not groundwater, it's unknown in soil, would this be considered VI? And this question is for Ryan or Lila. Let me know if you need me to repeat it.
I can jump in. So you might need some additional lines of evidence to answer the question about whether that's vapor intrusion or not. Looking at Yeah, so if you only had subslab soil vapor and indoor air, you're looking at a fairly local area. If groundwater is not impacted, the next step you might take is to look at soil gas samples to try and understand if there's a source further away from the building. So I think it would be difficult to make a decision about whether vapor intrusion is occurring or not just with sampling right around the immediate vicinity itself. You would have to basically define your source a little bit more clearly. So, Brian, do you have more to add?
Now, if you only have soil gas or subslab soil gas and indoor air, if as you mentioned, lines of evidence, you would have to follow to confirm whether or not there is an indoor air source. But let's say the indoor air source has been eliminated, that possibility has been excluded. Then, what I find is most regulatory authorities, they will consider it subsurface or soil gas impacts to be indicative of some sort of release, whether nearby groundwater or soil, which may be the case at a site like this where it's indicative of a release, just haven't found it yet.
So it does go back to something that Ryan mentioned with as far as the conceptual site model goes. That first step on whether you have a vapor intrusion issue or not is to understand what your subsurface source is. And so hopefully you have some information from, say, your phase two environmental assessment or some other nearby environmental investigation to better understand that source. And so I think that would be kind of the first place to start if you're thinking about whether it's a VI issue or not.
All right, thank you both. I just have a couple more questions before we continue. This one's quite long, so let me know if I need to repeat any. It's also open in the Q&A pod, the first question. I'm in an area where soil types and local uses, gas stations create bathtub conditions where very consolidated clays surround areas of fill, mostly fill sand, with much higher permeability. Little to no groundwater exists, so there is very little movement of source area that way as well. It would seem that diffusion rates would be much higher in those areas where no lateral movement of a source exists and lack of bioattenuation occurs because there is little chance for oxygen to help bugs eat the source. If there is a building placed on top of these conditions, should we be more concerned about vapor intrusion in these areas because of the localized conditions and possible higher diffusion of contaminants of concern?
So I can answer, at least provide one answer for this question. And yeah, I'm in the southeast where we have a lot of clay, and I think the state of Georgia has a total of maybe two petroleum vapor intrusion sites. And part of that is because of the, just the soil conditions. Petroleum hydrocarbons don't move a whole lot, so the ability to migrate via, via diffusion is somewhat limited. And but it's also important to remember that it really, I think it takes what is it, 2% oxygen to completely biodegrade the petroleum hydrocarbons. California uses a screening level of about I believe 4% oxygen, and really, and we're talking pretty high concentrations in the subsurface that can be completely non-detect within just a few inches vertically. Now, whether or not a building being placed on top of the site would create a concern, in my experience, anytime you add a building where there was no building, you've created a cap that prevents the any future off-gassing. So there is a potential for to really restrict the amount of diffusion and just allowing the vapors to escape. And of course, with gas stations and such, we also find that there's some methane problems. So you can actually create some increased subsurface pressure if there is degradation that could actually enhance some, potentially enhance some advective properties to push the vapors into the soil. So once a building is added to a site, you've really changed the conditions, and a follow-up evaluation would be needed.
All right, thanks, Ryan. One more question before we continue on with the training. In mixed contaminant sources, such as sites with PVI and non-PVI, how does this impact CSM development and potential mitigation strategies?
I'll jump in. This is Catherine. I think we're getting a little far ahead of where we are in our training here today. Certainly mitigation strategies, we have, if you're interested in those, there's two mitigation ITRC trainings, VIMS 1 and VIMS 2 that you can listen to. But generally, to answer the question, if you have both vapor-forming chemicals that are not petroleum-related and ones that are, it all comes down to the CSM and putting those pieces together that Ryan went through, because certainly the presence of chlorinateds in groundwater or the soil vapor could influence how petroleum hydrocarbons are broken down. So it comes back to that CSM that you're going to have to understand what that interaction is like, and then use that to help evaluate the potential for vapor intrusion.
And you may also have to collect more site-specific data. Your you may not be able to rely on some of these scientific study results that were really focused on petroleum or the chlorinated compounds.
All right, thank you. And thanks, Catherine, for jumping in there. Sorry I got a little ahead there. But maybe that's a little teaser. All right. And I believe I'll be passing this back to Lila to continue on with the training, and we'll have one more Q&A break at the end today. Thanks everyone for interacting with the Q&A pod.
Yes, thanks for the questions, and thanks, Catherine, and others lurking in the background and answering questions. The screens are arranged such that I can't see everything, so appreciate the assist. Okay, we are going to dive into the next section of the training, which is an introduction to data and decision making. All right, so as you might suspect, if you didn't know already, VI is often complicated. And there are a lot of examples where vapor intrusion is a concern, and a lot of examples when it's just not a concern because of a lot of different site-specific factors. So, how do you figure this out? Are there any off-ramps to this whole crazy puzzle? As Catherine just mentioned, really using your conceptual site model is critical. Use it as your touchstone to help you organize your thoughts, identify data gaps, plan your investigation, and then use it to guide your decision making. This chart just is a simple version of the pathway assessment process that's described in the ITRC Vapor Intrusion Toolkit. And Jennifer introduced this chart to you a little bit earlier. The pathway assessment process really has multiple stages in it. First, there's the preliminary vapor intrusion exposure assessment. Then there's a potential vapor intrusion assessment and evaluation, where you would start, collecting site-specific data to address VI specifically. And then you may phase into a vapor intrusion management or mitigation process. In each of these steps, your conceptual site model is used, and it just gets evolved and more detailed as you go along. Some other key points to note as we start talking about pathway assessment is that the process can be iterative, but at every stage, there are a number of considerations that are consistent throughout the whole thing. One is community engagement. Another is the potential for rapid response. Say, if you collect samples and the samples suggest there are high concentrations, you may want to think about doing interim measures promptly. And then each stage also has potential exits from vapor intrusion. Okay, so I'm going to proceed and talk a little bit more about these main stages in the next slides, starting with the preliminary VI exposure assessment. So this is done using existing site data, data that you might have collected when you first learned that there was a release in the property, for example. This preliminary vapor intrusion exposure assessment is an initial filter to determine if there's the potential for vapor intrusion based on the presence of volatile chemicals in the subsurface, which does require knowledge of historical or current chemical use. It also factors in the presence of current or reasonably anticipated future land use in buildings. So importantly, if neither of these conditions is present, or if only one is present, the site can be screened out from further vapor intrusion evaluation. If both conditions are present, then additional screening is needed. And that takes us to our VI assessment and evaluation box in the flowchart. So in the screening stages here, we are assuming that you do have subsurface VFCs and you do have a receptor. You ha do have some current or potential future building. The screening approaches are generally applied in a tiered or sequential manner, first with distance-based screening, then concentration-based screening, then mass flux-based screening. All of these screening approaches are conservative and they're meant to be protective, and each uses default exposure assumptions or scenarios. And so because of the conservatism that's built in and the assumptions that are built in, before using any approach, you should check the ITRC guidance for precluding factors. That is, factors that would limit the use of generic screen because of uncertainty. Okay, so I'm going to talk about each of these different types of screening next, starting with distance-based screening. So the goal of distance-based screening is to determine if vapors can migrate from your subsurface vapor source to your current or future building. The idea here is that buildings beyond a certain distance from your subsurface VFC source, buildings beyond that distance will not present a VI risk and require no additional vapor intrusion assessment. So typically, one would conduct the lateral screening distance first to identify buildings in map view, essentially, that fall within your inclusion distance. Then vertical screening is done on those buildings to understand if the building is close enough in the vertical sense to pose a potential VI risk. Shorter screening distances are typically used for biodegradable compounds, such as petroleum hydrocarbons, as we've discussed before, because of the high degree of degradation that occurs in the vato zone. So, for example, in many jurisdictions, the inclusion distance for non-petroleum compounds is 100 feet, both laterally and vertically, while distances for petroleum compounds are much less, say 30 feet laterally and less than 20 feet vertically. And that just reflects that degradation that we've seen over and over again in research studies and at actual sites. So it is important to also check your specific state's guidance on state-specific requirements. The majority of states around the US have adopted the screening distance, but not all have. Okay, concentration-based screening is next. Concentration-based screening is a more refined process that applies to buildings that don't screen out using the distance approach. With concentration-based screening, your vapor concentrations from environmental samples, such as groundwater samples, are compared to media-specific screening levels. These are calculated, as Ryan discussed earlier. So, in this example in the slide, samples from building A fall below the screening level. So, in that case, the building would screen out with no additional VI assessment, provided that the state's requirements are fully met. For example, some states may require more than one round of sampling to make a no further action decision. On the other hand, samples from building B exceed the screening level. This does not mean that vapor intrusion is occurring or will occur or will pose an unacceptable risk. It just means more actions are needed. These actions could include mass flux screening, site-specific screening level or risk evaluation, additional investigation, or in some cases, VI management or preemptive mitigation might be an option. Okay, mass flux-based screening is our third screening approach. This is a really relatively new approach, so I'm excited to see it described in the ITRC document. Mass flux is the rate of chemical mass flow through a unit area per unit time. So this approach evaluates the rate of VFC migration first through the vato zone, then near and across the building foundation, and then inside and out of a building. Additional vapor intrusion assessment is not required if the mass flux of VFCs to indoor air is sufficiently small to prevent the concentrations from exceeding indoor air screening levels. So this approach can provide a more accurate ro and robust estimate of the vapor intrusion potential. It better represents the actual migration in and out of buildings, and it does avoid some uncertainties with concentration-based screening that, for example, Ryan touched on with background sources. It does tend to require more information and a more evolved conceptual site model, though, than the other screening approaches. Okay, so if screening cannot determine if a site poses an unacceptable risk or cannot eliminate a site from further evaluation, then the next step is to conduct a more formal vapor intrusion investigation. This is a multi-step process. There are a lot of different options here that we'll discuss next. And some good figures in the ITRC document that describe the process are shown here. We don't expect you to read the slides, but they are figure 5-1 and 6-1 in the tech reg. Okay, so the vapor intrusion investigation itself can be an iterative process to collect enough data to make a confident decision. Decisions you make and the evaluations that you do would typically involve comparing concentration results to generic or site-specific or risk-based thresholds. You might also collect other types of data to help you understand what's happening at your site. These different types of data are useful for multiple lines of evidence or MLE approaches to data interpretation. The investigations themselves and different strategies are discussed more in the second part of this ITRC training. But before we move on, I'd like to talk a little bit more about MLE. And here to lead that discussion is Catherine Regan from Hale & Aldrich.
Thanks, Lila. All right, I think I have control. Yeah, so before we get into that example from Lila on a sort of a simple investigation process, first we wanted to discuss a little bit what we mean if you've never heard the term multiple lines of evidence or MLE. So Lila and I, for fun, digitized ourselves into these cartoons to kind of go through this process of what LOE, lines of evidence, or LOEs are, and how you would use that in a MLE or multiple lines of evidence approach. So just as we see on this slide, the lines of evidence are these pieces of data, all different types of data, not just concentration data, that we use to create this mental picture, mental or physical picture of our site. And when you pull all those pieces of data together, you can help understand your site and help answer a specific question. And these questions, in our case, are VI related. But if you can imagine, obviously, that this multiple lines of evidence approach can be used for anything. You could use it to help you figure out what restaurant you want to go to dinner to tonight. You're using little pieces of information to make a decision or ask a question and get an answer. So this is the same thing for our VI project lifecycle that we've talked a little bit about so far. You can use multiple lines of evidence to go through your screening process. You obviously use multiple pieces of information to build your conceptual site model. You can use it to figure out how you're going to investigate, so planning the site investigation as well as evaluating the data that you get from that site investigation. And then even in the mitigation and closeout piece, you're using multiple pieces of information to decide if your mitigation system is working as it was designed, or you're using multiple pieces of information to decide whether you can close out your site. So when I'm asking a question where I'm going to use sort of a classic multiple lines of evidence approach, what I like to do is ask the question sort of as simply as possible. And obviously, once you go past one question, you can ask yourself the next one. I find that a little less overwhelming than gathering all the data around from my site and then looking at it and saying, what does it all mean? Right? If you can ask questions sort of as yes and no questions, that might help focus you and figure out which pieces of information you're going to use to answer the question, do I have a VIP, a VI preferential pathway? And then you can use another set of data potentially to answer the question of, do I think VI is likely occurring? Or another question, separate question, do I think VI is likely to occur in the future? So separating it out into sort of steps like this may help help organize your thoughts on how to do a multiple lines of evidence approach. So as just an example, so we have a multiple lines of evidence fact sheet that's new to the toolkit this year, and it lists a ton of lines of evidence or things that could be used as lines of evidence for vapor intrusion projects. So this example here is just a way to kind of conceptualize what that might look like. So kind of building it like a picture. So Components of CSM are lines of evidence, right? How deep is my groundwater? What kind of soil do I have? Do I have a clean water lens, like Lila mentioned before? What is my site used for? Is there a building there or is there not a building? What's the history, right? Those are all lines of evidence. Those help you answer those questions. And then the building evaluation data that you collect, how is my building designed or constructed, right? That's important. The chemical inventory, what's used or stored inside the building, what chemicals are used also. Those are all pieces of information, those lines of evidence. And then the more classic, what we all think about, right, is data. So media specific data like groundwater concentrations or subslab vapor concentrations or indoor and outdoor air data, right? Those concentrations compared to screening levels that you might have in your state or federal are pieces of information, lines of evidence. But then you can also do interpretations on those data, which I would consider to be additional lines of evidence. So that would be something like data trends over time, right? Do my concentrations go up or down, stay the same? Spatial and temporal, those trends in both time and space. So do concentrations stay the same across the site? Do they change? And then you can also do other things with your data. We call it forensics or data interpretation. In this case, on my screen just splashed a bunch of pie charts. So those are the ratio of all the different VOCs or VFCs we see in groundwater versus soil vapor versus indoor air and outdoor air, right? Do those constituent ratios look the same across the different media is an important way to look at your data. And then other things I'm not showing on this slide, but you can do, some people call those attenuation factors. You can look at your site-specific attenuation factors across media and across different compounds. You can manipulate your building. You can do pressure control tests. So depressurize and overpressurize your building and look at your indoor air results in different conditions. That's another line of evidence that people use. And just looking at that general natural differential pressure, so the pressure inside the building compared to the pressure underneath the building, you can use that as a line of evidence and many, many more. Table three, I think it is in the fact sheet, lists a bunch of lines of evidence that may be helpful for understanding your site and answering questions about your site. So one last slide on multiple lines of evidence. It is very important for you to look to see what in your particular state is in the regulatory guidance there, because some states will weight more different lines of evidence over others. So the importance of a line of evidence may be weighted differently depending on your state. And then also, obviously understand that a lot of these lines of evidence may come with some uncertainty, right? Concentrations change over time. So that all has to be sort of put into your sort of professional judgment as you evaluate these lines of evidence. And also, and unfortunately, but this is true, but this is why we all sort of have jobs in this field, is that not every line of evidence is going to point in the same direction. Some may say, yes, VI is occurring, and then another line of evidence for that same site may say no, based on this data line, VI is not occurring. So there is going to be potentially some discrepancy, and that, of course, is going to come down to you and your professional judgment and sort of the collective data that you have for your site. And even though that table three in the fact sheet is very, very long, you don't need to collect every single line of evidence for every single site every time, right? There's might oh maybe a different set for each question that you're trying to answer, or for each site just based on logistics and what you have. So these are just tools that you can use to help you evaluate as you go through the VI project lifecycle. So now that you have that as your sort of background on multiple lines of evidence, Lila, I'm going to turn it back to you. You have this investigation example to go through.
Thanks, Catherine. Okay, so we're going to run through this example to put together these pieces and illustrate how your CSM and your EMILI come together as you're planning an investigation. So, in this example, we have a building here that is located above or near vapor impacted groundwater. So we don't know exactly the extent of the plume, but it's close. We know it's close to the building. It might be under the building. It is an occupied building, and the building has a basement and an attached garage. And so what we want to know here is the vapor intrusion pathway complete or potentially complete? So to answer this question, there are a lot of different options and a lot of different things we can test. We could A, collect a groundwater sample to just get a better understanding of the concentrations of the subsurface source. We could collect soil gas samples at, say, location B, basically following the potential pathway to the building. We could collect soil gas samples underneath the building, a subslab soil gas sample at, say, location C, or we can collect samples of indoor and outdoor air. Important to remember, and as Catherine mentioned, it's not needed to test all the possible sample locations. We just want to think strategically about how do we best answer this question about is the vapor intrusion pathway complete? And we're going to ask the audience this question. What would you guys sample first, given this set of facts? So we'll just pick one. And I'll let Taylor call time when she sees fit.
Yep, just a couple more seconds for people to respond.
Okay.
All right, I'm going to close it and share the results now.
Great. Yeah, that's great. So there are a lot of right answers, as suggested by the poll responses. If there's a lot of uncertainty in the source concentration, then yeah, groundwater is a good next step. Soil gas and the building specific samples, those are also good next steps. You might do soil gas, for example, if you have a kind of a thick vadose zone, you have room to move, and you want to look at concentration reduction in the vadose zone as you're moving towards the building. You might do that if you can't get access to indoor and outdoor air, or in the indoors and the outdoors. So lots of good answers there. So I'm going to close the poll and then talk about the answer I put, at least in the slides. So in the slides, we'll assume for the sake of argument that only building testing was done. That is our location C in the subslab and then D, indoor and outdoors. The yellow circles on the figure show the relative magnitude of the concentration result. So as you can see here, the highest concentrations overall were in the subslab in my example, and the concentrations decrease as I go up. So in this example, this is the classic interpretation that vapor intrusion is occurring. And the pattern that you're seeing here is this decreasing upward concentration gradient. But what if you have something that looks like this? So in scenario number two here, my results are kind of all over the place with say my subslab being the same as what's in the garage. So, you know, what's happening? So the classic interpretation here, if you're only looking at concentration data, is I don't know. So the important point here is that the detection of VOCs in indoor air does not necessarily mean that vapor intrusion is happening. It does tell you that you need multiple lines of evidence to interpret what's going on. Some typical lines of evidence that you might think of if you're dealing with this particular scenario of building specific data is looking, say, at indoor air concentrations. Are they higher than normal levels? Something else you might ask yourself is, does the pattern suggest vapor intrusion? You know, do I, you know, look at the spatial distribution laterally and vertically? Do I have that vertically decreasing pattern that would suggest vapor intrusion? In the subslab, are my subslab vapor concentrations high enough to cause an impact to indoor air? And then finally, are there other sources of vapors in the house? So chemical inventories and understanding of chemicals used inside the building, that also turns out to be really important in understanding if vapor intrusion is a concern or not. This issue of indoor sources of volatile chemicals is a really common one that plagues many vapor intrusion investigations. It definitely can complicate interpretation of indoor air results because there are many, many sources of chemicals to air that are completely unrelated to vapor intrusion. You could have household or commercial chemical products that are stored in the building, say chemicals underneath your sink or in a flammables cabinet in a commercial building. You could have chemicals that are used in the building. Say you have a cleaning crew that comes in and uses carpet cleaner, spot cleaner. Those can contain chemicals like trichloroethylene, for instance. And it doesn't take much chemical use to result in indoor air concentrations that are higher than your screening levels. So you can also have building materials that off-gas different chemicals. You can also have outdoor air, vehicle exhaust has a variety of different chemicals in it, including benzene often. You could have chemicals in outdoor air that come to indoor air and impact indoor air just through the natural building exchange. So the ITRC toolkit has a background fact sheet that has a lot of information and a lot of different studies that summarize different background concentrations and different types of chemicals that people have found. So that's a really good one to look at if you're thinking about indoor sources of chemicals. There are also a number of specialized sampling approaches that have been developed to help distinguish between vapor intrusion and indoor sources. And that'll be covered in session two of this training course. Okay, so there are a lot of different things to think about, as we've been mentioning, a lot of different considerations for data interpretation. And factoring in background sources is definitely an important one. There are other data interpretation considerations that are listed here. They include temporal variability. So, as an example, indoor air concentrations from vapor intrusion can vary over time due to changes in source strength or soil moisture, which can affect diffusion, seasonal variations that affect the subsurface, but also seasonal variations that affect your building conditions, whether you're using your air conditioning or not, for example. Spatial variability is also another consideration. So within a building, you can get elevated indoor concentrations or hot spots, so to speak, that result from localized emission sources like background sources or vapor entry points. Across a project area, you can also see a lot of spatial variation with different subsurface source concentrations across, say, a neighborhood or a large site. The timing of the response is a policy consideration. Because many different state agencies have rapid response action levels that, if exceeded, will trigger an interim response while the rest of the investigation is ongoing or some remediation is completed. So it's important to be aware of your regulatory framework and the specific requirements for your site. So there's a lot of different moving parts here, and as we've discussed, there's a wide variety of data and information that could be collected. And certainly our friends Emily and Eloise can help with your data interpretation. It is also important to recognize that regulatory requirements differ across the United States, and it's critical to understand the specific requirements for data collection and handling lines of evidence in areas where you work. And to show how this plays out, I'm going to pass it back to Catherine to give us an example of how different states might handle the same data set.
Yeah, thanks, Isla. So this is a very simplistic example, just to give you a sense of what it's like to sort of move across the country and do VI evaluations. And you know, this may be applicable to you if you're an environmental consultant or private industry where you have to work or buy sites or properties in different states. If you're a regulator in a specific state, maybe applies less to you, but also it's just good as a state regulator to sort of understand how your neighbors may be dealing with similar or same issues as you, just to get some perspective and context. So this is a hypothetical site. We'll say it's a dissolved phase groundwater plume of PCE, tetrachloroethylene. So you can see here our little, it's not a house, it's a, we'll call it a commercial building there. And we have groundwater PCE concentrations you can see in the little figure, and that there's been some subslab vapor concentrations collected. You can see those. And then there's also been an indoor air sample. So obviously, this is a super, super simple snapshot. No other information that we're showing here, but just to give you an idea of what this would look like. So now I'm going to take this building and its impacted groundwater, and I'm going to move it across the country from west to east, well, sort of west to east to the middle, going from left to right here. If that same site was sitting in California, then potentially the interpretation of that data would show, as you can see, we sort of listed it out here. This might show that no current mitigation is needed. Indoor air is below their risk thresholds. It was non-detect. But there might be a potential for future risk. So they would say, reassess if conditions change. And California is a big state, so I understand different sub-regulatory departments and air districts might answer this differently, but this was our answer from one of our team members who works as a regulator in California. Now let's bring that building all the way back to the East Coast where I am, and what would that look like in Delaware based on Delaware's guidance? This would screen out. It's an incomplete pathway because there is no detections in indoor air, and there would be no additional actions warranted. So slightly different than California. And then let's bring it back to somewhat in the middle of the country into Wisconsin, and based on this data alone, they would recommend active mitigation, purely based, I believe, on the subslab vapor concentrations exceeding their screening levels, and that there would be, post-mitigation commissioning assessments that would need to happen. So three very different answers on the exact same building with the exact same data, just in three different states. So just something to keep in mind again, if you work across different states. And even if you are only working in one state, but maybe getting consultants who are looking at sites in your state and giving you a very different answer, maybe because they have different experience just because of where they are. Excuse me, let me take a drink here. So a little wrap up on this last section that Lila and I were talking about on data and decisions. We are scraping the surface here, right? This is a VI 101 training class here. There's a lot more information, obviously, in the guidance, in the guidance that we created, and all of the fact sheets and tech sheets that are in the guidance. What you could take away from what we talked about so far is that this investigation and analysis and evaluation process is iterative. You can screen sites, as Lila talked about, with some screen data with existing data, or you collect additional data for further screening or data evaluation, and then you lean on that conceptual site model that you've created and these multiple lines of evidence to make further VI management decisions. And if you do end up in VI management, then we do have, like I mentioned earlier during the Q&A, separate ITRC trainings for VI mitigation specifically. And this simplified VI project stages that you see on the right, it shows up very differently in the guidance with a lot more detail that we didn't want to include in this on our slides because it's too hard to read. But that flow chart has a lot more detail on it in the guidance document and more like links to get to different places to find out more. So now back to our training roadmap. We've gone through the first three circles here. And as Jennifer said at the beginning, we're ending this training session today with stakeholder communication. And although you see it on our flowchart across all of the aspects of VI data collection and evaluation and mitigation, want to talk about it at the end so that you had a little bit of a context of what VI was and how we would investigate it before we talked about communicating with stakeholders. So, community engagement during vapor intrusion can look a lot different than if you've done other types of environmental actions in the community, so groundwater or soil sampling, that kind of thing, because vapor intrusion primarily assessments primarily take place indoors, so in your homes and in your apartment buildings and in the stores that you go to every day. It's about the air that people breathe. In my town we have well water, but if the well water wasn't good anymore, we'd get bottled water or we'd get on to a water treatment plant, right? We have options for what we drink. We don't necessarily have options for what we breathe. It's not something that we can avoid. I say the words vapor intrusion every day, all the time, right? But probably the words vapor and intrusion don't enter anybody else's daily lingo. So it is incredibly unfamiliar to the public. If it is familiar, it is often familiar for very negative reasons, right? Something they've seen in the news, something that is scary and concerning. So the language is unfamiliar, but if but they also might have a lot of anxiety around it because it might be something that they've heard about that isn't good. So this is for these reasons, it is really important for project teams and state regulators to be highly involved with the community and make sure they engage with them frequently and repeatedly. And this is why we have an entire chapter on community engagement in our technical guidance that we've created. So speaking of lingo, like I mentioned, these words are unfamiliar, and there is lots of other pieces that are unfamiliar to what to the community for what we do here. So more than just the words vapor intrusion, all the things that we do, attenuation and mitigation, these words are not things that people use in their everyday lives. In addition, the things that we measure and that we compare to, it's not a above or below some bright line, right? We're collecting lots of data. Data is variable. And we compare it to a lot of different things. We do this multiple lines of evidence evaluation, right? So it's not just below, above, or below. It's sort of, let's look at all this data collectively and make a decision about it. The other piece that's complicating it is that very often people are using, as Lila mentioned already, things in their everyday life that are the same vapor forming chemicals as what we may be looking for as well. Cars run on gasoline, gasoline has benzene in it. Clothes get dry cleaned, and in some states can be dry cleaned still with PCE. So there's things in people's indoor air that they don't even know is there, that would be concerning, that also can confound a vapor intrusion evaluation that we also need to communicate to them. So what do we have to do here? What are the key components for engaging with the community? It is always good to plan ahead. Oftentimes, we will get to being maybe the week before or the day before a VI sampling event, and someone asks the question, "Hey, has anyone thought about like how we're going to engage if we get asked a question?" And then there's a scramble for trying to figure out what kind of questions we might get asked, who's available to answer them, how are they going to be answered. Don't do that, right? Plan to reach out to have a plan, have a plan ahead of time, and make sure you're reaching out early and often to the community that you're going to be, involved with for potentially a long-term period of time. These relationships that you have with the community are really important. I have an example where we had a field person who had been engaging with a community, a neighborhood for a very long time, and they had such trust with her and with the project that when the project was transitioning to another phase and she was leaving the project, she had to go and individually say goodbye to every single resident in of every single home in that neighborhood because she had such a good relationship with them. So those relationships and maintaining those relationships build trust, And that will help make sure that your project that you're able to move forward with your project and how it needs to be moved forward. And at the same time, you may need to recruit partners. So translators, if needed, community organizers, local departments of health, even the mayor, right? Sometimes you need to go as up the political chain to make sure that you have partners for your VI project as needed. And listening, right? There's a lot that I could say about VI, but I also need to listen to the concerns and the questions of the residents and make excuse me, and make sure that that we're taking all of their concerns seriously and that we're re answering them as best we can. So questions from the public don't always have to do with the specifics of the chemistry or the science of what we're doing. They could be logistical questions, right? I don't want my pets to be let out when you come in to do the sampling. Or can you come in after 5 because I work from 9 to 5? Or, how much do I have to pay you to do this, right? And those kind of questions, thinking about them ahead of time and making sure that you know an answer or have some information that would help them, and whether you leave behind some information with them in case they think of a question later, maybe a frequently asked questions flyer is something that you're going to think about as part of your community engagement plan. Skipped one. So like I just said, so you might have documents that you need to prepare to help you with your communications and tools. They could be fact sheets again that you leave behind. They could be frequently asked questions that either you have in your back pocket in case you get asked a question, or again, something that you might want to leave with a homeowner. And you may have these conversations or be prepared to have these conversations multiple times, even with the same party. You may sit down with them at their kitchen table and have this conversation about sampling that you're going to do. You may talk to them again in a public meeting. You may go back to their kitchen table and talk to them again. You may talk to them on the phone. You're going to have the conversation more than once, even with the same person. And as I just said, it could be multiple different ways, right? In a group, one-on-one. But we're not going to, oh, and one more thing here is it's everyone's job to remember it's not just, the person who knows the most about the job, maybe your vapor intrusion specialist. It's the person in the field collecting the sample. It's the project manager. It's the state regulator who's responsible for that project. Everyone needs to know their role and or needs to know who they can direct questions to. Oh, one other piece to on this slide to be mindful of is depending on the situation, you may have both tenants or renters and property owners. And depending on what state you're in, there are different rules and regulations around who you can talk to and who you can share information with. So just make sure that you know how you're going to handle that in your particular state. And like I said, this is a really important topic, and we have an entire chapter that is related to community engagement specific to vapor intrusion. ITRC, also outside of the Vapor Intrusion Toolkit, has a risk communication toolkit. It's a separate document. It was written and published in 2020 that just talks about risk communication in general. So that also may be helpful for you to take a look at as you're planning community engagement process. So we've gone through all four of our roadmap circles. We started with those VI basics, how vapors move and migrate in the subsurface, and then really tried to come at it in a few different ways, this idea of the conceptual site model and the picture of your site and the lines of evidence that create that picture, and how it's very important to understand the source. A lot of talked about this, the pathway, that migration, and the receptor, and you need those three pieces. Multiple lines of evidence to understand your data and communication is key. One thing that we didn't talk about, it's underlined on this slide because I believe it's a link, is that this is it's a learning curve for vapor intrusion evaluations. They are different than soil and groundwater sampling and soil and groundwater impact projects. There's lots of mistakes that you can make. And a couple of those mistakes we've kind of collated into a common mistakes fact sheet. It's again a new fact sheet for this toolkit this time around, and try to put in there some shared experiences that folks on the VI team have had in the past that, you know, maybe would help you going forward and don't make the same mistakes that maybe we did at one point. So with that, what is next is that is the end of our part one of the VI 101 or intro to concepts session. There is a part two that I believe you're automatically registered for if you sign up for part one. We also have a few other things here. We've already mentioned the VI mitigation one and two training that's out there and was refreshed and redone. If you took it in 2020-ish timeframe, we've changed it. It's newer now, so you can certainly welcome to listen to it again. There is also a vapor intrusion YouTube playlist that one of the subgroups of our team put together to collate information and videos that are out there that may be helpful for you in understanding how to do sampling, how to communicate with stakeholders, all sorts of vapor intrusion related content there. And I believe with that, we're at our final Q&A break, Taylor.
All right, yes. Thank you, Catherine. We have reached our final Q&A break for the training before we wrap up today. And I do have a couple of questions for our trainers from the second half of the training today. First question I have, how can I respond to a homeowner or business owner who asks how soil gas sampling or testing for PCE vapor intrusion would affect them when they want to sell their house or business?
I can jump on that one. Well, with the sampling itself, in many times we can actually conduct the sampling during off hours where there's a little bit less visibility. That's easier to do in a non-residential setting, obviously. Now, if we're talking more about, you know, what if we have PCE detections and soil gas nearby, will it impact, you know, property values? That's really a question for local appraisers. I have seen situations where just because the housing market was in a boom that you know, during the process of an investigation, properties were selling for you know 50 times higher than they originally were, or at least or some increase in cost. I haven't run across too many situations where property values have actually declined. It probably depends a good bit on, you know, on the situation and the area, but for sampling itself, there are ways to become a little bit more invisible during the sampling process.
Yeah, Ryan, this is Jennifer, and I'll just add on to that what I've personally experienced is that a lot of times finding the answer to whether or not a building is being impacted by vapor intrusion can actually eliminate any concern about environmental contamination. So if they're within a screening distance and they need to be sampled, but they're not allowing access because they're concerned about, you know, being impacted, that's actually could be more detrimental to them and, you know, for future prospective purchasers than if they were to sample and either find out that they're not impacted, there's not a concern, and have that data to show, or find that they are impacted and get an appropriate mitigation system in place to show that the building is protected. So, you know, there's a lot of different angles, and it really depends on, I think, what the concern of the homeowner or the building owner or business owner are. And there's ways to kind of address that. But I agree with what Ryan was saying as well, is that a lot of times that comes down to individual assessors.
All right. Thank you, Ryan. Thank you, Jennifer. And one more question here before we wrap up. If you see compounds in indoor air that are not in nearby soil, groundwater, or soil vapor, can you generally assume the indoor air concentrations are from an indoor or non-environmental contaminant source?
I'll jump in. an answer that I think I also answered it in the Q&A. It always comes back. It's you never want to make any assumptions, right? We want to come back to those multiple lines of evidence that we talked about and that conceptual site model. Based on that small amount of information, it certainly would be very possible that you have chemicals that are used in the space, but also and because a lot of bunch of this too, don't forget it could also be gosh, it could be chloroform from water, drinking water that's in the area, or it could be off-gassing from soft surfaces or from carpeting or from materials that are in the space that obviously don't like come with their own safety data sheet like a chemical product does. So certainly possible that there's a background source of something in the space if you don't have any impacts to groundwater and you don't have any impacts to soil vapor and you don't have any impacts to indoor air. That small little snapshot, it does seem like it, but you always want to, pull together your lines of evidence to make that assessment versus just an assumption.
I can expand on that a little bit. It would also, as Catherine said, additional lines of evidence, which could also be what are the compounds that are detected in indoor air. If it's there are a lot of compounds that are in air fresheners, Glade plug-ins. We see a lot. There's also background outdoor air concentrations of numerous chemicals, and many of which you just can't find a point source. So, in that as thinking along those lines, that's why we get outdoor air samples really typically upwind of the building, or in California where you have upwind of the building, downwind of the building, and sometimes crosswind. So the additional information can provide some clarity.
All right, great. Thank you so much, Catherine and Ryan. I think that brings us to the end of our training today, the end of this Q&A. So I wanted to quickly thank our expert trainers, as well as our subject matter experts for being here today and getting us through this training and helping with the Q&A in the background, and for their contribution to the ITRC document. And I also want to thank you all, for being here, interacting with the Q&A pod throughout the training today. And we would like to hear back from you. So please be sure to fill out the online feedback form that's linked on this last slide. Filling out the feedback form and certifying that you participated will allow you to receive a certificate of completion by email. If you need further clarification on the answers or would like to ask more questions, feel free to email us at itrc@itrcweb.org and we will follow up with our trainers to get your questions answered. Thanks again, everyone, and see you at session two.